From the Land Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It is the 18th day of June 2010. I'm Todd Gleason. In a few moments, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Mike Azuzalo of Global Commodity Analytics in Lafayette, Indiana. And later in this half hour, we'll discuss the cash grain market with Bruce Bostard. He's the manager of the Ludlow Co-op Elevator Company out of Ludlow, Illinois. In agricultural news, U.S. EPA hopes to make a decision about raising the ethanol blend rate, but it's putting it off for a few more months. And Brazil is coming back to the well after getting an agreement from the U.S. government earlier this year on GSM 102 cotton subsidies, and it's paid off. Again, Dave Dickey will have details of these stories shortly. In the second half hour of our program, we call that the Farming World, we'll hear our weekly In My Backyard feature from Lisa Braltz and discuss the agricultural transportation system with Bruce Blanton. It all happens on this Friday edition of the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. It is a production of the University of Illinois.
This stock and commodity report on Illinois Public Media is made possible with support from Bates Commodities in Normal, providing clients with the latest market information based on research by ADM Investor Services and other independent sources. Bates Commodities can be reached at 1-800-383-4647 or on the internet at batescom.net.
In Chicago on this Friday afternoon, futures finished the day like this. Settlement in Chicago for July wheat at 461 and three quarters, down a penny today. July hard red at 497 and a quarter in Kansas City, up a penny and three quarters. From the corn pit nearby, July contract, 360 and three quarters, up three and one quarter of a cent. September at 370, 3 cents higher, and December corn at 380 and a half, up two and a quarter. March futures there, 393 and one half, up two and a quarter, and the May contract at 402 and a half, up 2.5 cents. July of next year at $4.10, up 2 cents for the day, and December 2011 at $4.12, up a penny and three quarters. July soybean futures, 961, up 9 cents. August at 951, 6 3/4 higher. September at 937 and three quarters, 6.5 higher. November at 930 and a half, up 5.5, and the Jans at 939 and three quarters, up 5 3/4. Bean meal, July contract at 289.40, up 3.40. July bean oil at 37.92, 13 lower on the afternoon. June live cattle futures, 89.30, down 30. August feeders at 110.17.5, up 2.5 cents. And July lean hog futures at $80.87.5, 52.5 cents. On this Friday afternoon, you are listening to the Closing Market Report. It is a production of Illinois Public Media from the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois. Here's what the outside markets look like for the hour. July crude oil futures, $77.24, down, or rather up 45 cents a barrel. July ethanol at $1.62 4/10, up 4 tenths of a cent. Natural gas at $5 a penny and 3 tenths, down 14 9/10 of a cent for the day. And July heating oil at $2.13 even, just about a penny and 6 tenths of a cent lower. Gold futures at $1,257.20, a settlement price there up $9.70, the Dow 26 points higher at 10,461, the dollar at 85.69 is down 0.007, and the CRB index at 292.93 is down 0.37 on the day. Here's what the weather forecast says. For the Midwest, thunderstorms will return tonight and Saturday, and we'll follow up with a bit of rainfall. That'll be possible on Sunday. Warm and humid weather likely through the next week to 10 days. Net drying likely from Kansas City to the lower Ohio River Valley. Soil moisture remains plentiful across the Midwest. Daily high temperatures in the 80s and the lower to mid-90s will occur through much of the coming week. Somewhat cooler, though, for the weekend in the Great Lakes region. That'll reach into the northern part of Illinois and northern Indiana. Another bout of cooler weather reaching into the northern parts of Illinois and Indiana a week from now as well. We'll take a more complete look at the weather forecast at the bottom of this half hour when we talk with the folks at the Midwestern Regional Climate Center.
Todd Gleason services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report. It is a production of Illinois Public Media. On this Friday afternoon, time to check out the agricultural futures markets. On the line with us, Mike Zuzulo of Global Commodity Analytics and Consulting out of Lafayette, Indiana. Good afternoon to you, Mike.
Hey there, Todd.
How are you today?
Hey, we're doing great.
Okay, a couple of things that we need to cover. Probably ought to go through the Informa numbers and the cattle on feed numbers. Both of those were out today. Let's start with cattle on feed. They were released at the top of the hour, 2 o'clock Central Time. And they say as of June the 1st on feed at 101, that's 101%, and within the range and really close to what the average guess might have been. Placements during May at 123%, as not so expected, 123.6%. Was the average guess, not so expected because that's pretty big, I suppose, when you look at it, but that's where it is. And marketings during May were at 96%, and that one's right on the average guess, too. So what do you think of that 123? I know the trade was expecting it, but confirmation at least.
Yeah, we're probably coming off of a record, you know, month last year of record low month, Todd, and that probably made the numbers skewed a little bit. I think we're right around 3%. Higher than the five-year average. So we are up there. I'm wondering whether if the technicals hold up on Monday's trade, whether the hot, dry weather in the southern plains, I think it's going to be around 105 degrees in the panhandle pretty much all week next week. I'm wondering if that won't give a boost to the market next week. We also are in the middle of the 4th of July buying seasonal by the packers, and I've been hearing that we're running light on market-ready hogs, so we might actually see packers switching and turning to cattle. So I think you've got a few things going for you with a mostly neutral report, but I think the key will be that the early week technicals hold up after that placements numbers digested.
And let's switch to the grains and the oil seeds, and we'll go through the Informa numbers, I think, as we go through each of them. So let's start with corn. Informa with corn acreage now predicted at 89.3 million acres. Of course, we'll learn at the end of this month what USDA says is actually out there. Their intentions report from March 30th showed 88.8 million acres, so the Informa number just a bit bigger. You think they're right?
I think the trade is probably trading exactly right around that number. That 89.3 to 89.5 level seems to be a number that resonates with a lot of people that I've talked to. May numbers by Informa was 89.6, so we actually saw a little bit of a decline. And I think the trade saw that as well.
And your expectation, what number did you put on it?
I had 89.3 on the June estimate. I think I'm probably going to stick with that. I have probably, at this point, I've elected with the wet weather and based upon clients, I'm going to delay my survey by 1 month.
The National Weather Service has issued a severe thunderstorm watch, which continues until 7 p.m., for an area including Ford, Iroquois, and McLean counties. Again, a severe thunderstorm watch until 7 p.m. for Ford, Iroquois, and McLean counties.
So it's probably going to be hard to get the acreage number down until at least July, August.
And stay with the corn and talk to me about what the trade was like for you today.
I like the corn trade initially, Todd. I think whether you're talking corn, beans, or wheat, I would have liked a better technical close because we do have mixed fundamentals in the corn market, especially. We have the Chinese lack of demand, you know, no new news about China. I think the trade was a little bit disappointed by that. Most important, I think the trade was disappointed by the idea that the EPA is going to push out the ethanol increase in terms of blend rate increase at least until fall. The thing I liked about corn today was the idea that the trade seemed to start to pick up things that I've been hearing this week as well from clients and producers that I literally have talked to clients the exact same day in the same state that have said, I've got the best crop of corn being grown right now, and another client would say, I've got one of the worst crops I've ever seen being grown right now. Both of them correct because one of them in one of those corridors of extremely wet weather and one of them in the ideal garden spot areas. And so I think the trade picked up on that in corn today, especially because I actually saw some newswire reports where they're saying a little bit too much of a good thing in terms of the rain and the expectations for next week of another 2 or 3 inches running through Illinois and Indiana didn't get the trade very bearish. They actually think it's too much of a good thing now.
Yeah, you think let's see, we topped out these corn at 384 and three quarters today, finished at 380 and a half. You think that's high enough for the moment?
yeah, it probably is without the help of the wheat or the beans. I really didn't like the way the wheat closed, but we can get into more than that if you want to. But I really wanted to see 385 tested. We got there when you look at it from a standpoint of hand grenades. We're close enough to have tested that trend line. The nice thing was we did stay above 380, so you don't see the chart rolling over in corn kind of like you do in the wheat right now.
Okay, and then let's bring in some Informa numbers because that'll have some impact, I suppose. They say the spring wheat planting's at 13.5 million acres, and that's just below the 13.9 that USDA was suggesting. And were things that bad up north?
I think they are, and I think that even that number from Informa is probably more of a dart at this point to throw at a board because we just don't know how bad is because the heaviest rain totals are still yet to come from what I understand that Canada's heaviest rains are still yet to come this weekend. So I think losses still could be accruing of stuff that's already been planted, quite frankly.
Yeah, so Informa saying not as many acres as USDA suspected, and then you throw the rain on top of that. With the acres that are there and the disease, and we have a problem.
Yeah, we really do. And I think that's where probably initially at midday when those numbers came out, that Informa number probably was the spark that allowed the Minneapolis and the KC wheat to rally. But I sat there and I thought about the KC wheat, and I thought, gosh, this is kind of a harvest Friday. We're looking at the same 105-degree temperatures in the panhandle for cattle, and we are for hard red wheat. I've talked to clients in Texas and Oklahoma and Kansas this week, and they're going to go at it next week if they – see these temperatures come out as high as they could be. So why are we rallying right now, Nick? I think by the end of the day, the trade kind of exasperated itself and exhausted itself and wanted to take some money home. I also heard from the EFG guys that there was some pre-hedging going on. That makes a lot of sense as well.
And for the soy complex, let's wrap her up. Seedings from Informa at 78.8 million. That's from the 78.1 that up from there from what USDA predicted on March the 30th.
Beans really impressed me when that number came out because they took a pause and they didn't want to go up anymore, and they sat there for about a half an hour, 45 minutes to digest that number. But when the trade looked at the cash meal and cash bean basis and saw the meal start to make new highs on the close and the bull spread started to work again, which made sense given that bigger number for 2010 bean acres, when they saw that all work together again, I think they decided to come back on it and buy into it into the closing bell. Definitely the best performer of the week in my mind and the best of the day.
And what can we expect next week?
Well, I think, again, I would have liked to have seen a better technical close because we have mixed fundamentals across the board, and we've had a good rally since the report, so we kind of need some momentum, and I think that momentum needs to come from the technicals. So if we hold up Monday, we see a lower crop conditions report and disappointing winter wheat harvest numbers, I think we could continue this week's rally and move it up to the next notch. But I think that if we don't see something to kind of feed the momentum because we didn't have the technicals on our side today on the close, then maybe we'll have to pull back and wait for the report.
Okay, thanks so much.
Hey, Todd, have a good weekend, sir. Happy Father's Day.
Hey, same to you. That's Mike Zuzel. He's with Global Commodity Analytics and Consulting in Lafayette, Indiana. Joins us here on the Closing Mark Report on a Friday afternoon.
Support for the Closing Market Report comes from AgriGold Hybrids, featuring the AgriGold Giants, a group of five new hybrids designed to meet the performance standards of yield, health, and consistency required by Midwestern corn growers. More information is at AgriGoldGiants.com or at 800-262-7333.
You, of course, are listening to the Closing Market Report. It's a production of Illinois Public Media. Dave Dickey is here now. He'll take us through all the agricultural news for this Friday afternoon.
In agricultural news, U.S. environmental regulators said yesterday that they hope to make a decision on higher ethanol blends by the fall, a month or two later than had been expected. The Environmental Protection Agency said it expects the Department of Energy to complete testing on higher blends on cars built after 2007 by the end of September. The tests had been expected to be completed later this month. The Renewable Fuels Association said in a news release that EPA is adding insult to injury by only considering the higher blend rate in 2007 or newer vehicles.
The Brazilian government's Foreign Trade Commission announced yesterday that an agreement has been reached with the U.S. government on ways to avoid trade retaliation in a case involving U.S. subsidies to cotton farmers. In a written statement, the panel said, quote, "The agreement does not represent a final solution to the problem, but it does set parameters for a final settlement and foresees the gradual and substantial reduction in the harm done by U.S. farm subsidies." The statement indicated that the U.S. has pledged itself to gradually reduce such subsidies even before the 2012 congressional review of the U.S. farm program. The accord reached yesterday will include U.S. financial support for Brazilian cotton growers to total $147.3 million a year. The World Bank today says that China's economic prospects remain good despite the frailty of the global recovery. In a quarterly economic update, the bank restated its long-standing recommendation that China raise interest rates and allow greater exchange rate flexibility so it can better tailor monetary policy to its domestic needs. The World Bank kept China's forecast for 2010 gross domestic product growth unchanged at 9.5% and penciled in 8.5% for 2011. That is a touch lower than the 8.7% forecast in the bank's previous update in March. Meanwhile, China told the rest of the world today not to meddle with the way it manages the yuan, calling the exchange rate a sovereign matter for it alone to decide, and all but ruling it would be out of bounds at next week's G20 summit. China has kept the yuan steady around 6.83 per dollar for almost 2 years to help its exporters ride out the global financial crisis. Many Western economists believe it is undervalued by as much as 40%. And that's a look at today's agricultural news.
Hey, thanks, Dave. Dave Dickey is Director of Agricultural Programming for Illinois Public Media. That's public radio for the farming world. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason, the host of the Closing Market Report and of Commodity Week, that second program you can hear anytime you'd like on our website at willag.org. John Bondurant is our guest this week. We'll post it by about 6 o'clock this evening. We'll record at 4:30 on Friday afternoons. Well, up next, you know, grazing animals graze in different ways because of their mouth parts. We'll hear more from University of Illinois Extension. There are lots of animals that graze. We think mostly of cows, but grazing animals include sheep and goats and even horses. University of Illinois Extension Animal Systems team educator Dean Oswald says it's very important to know the grazing preferences and habits of the animals on your farm if pasture management is to play a role in their health and productivity.
For example, sheep prefer grass that is 2 to 6 inches tall. So if in a managed grazing program, we like to move them out of a pasture when we have 3 to 4 inches of growth remaining, we realize quickly that sheep, just because of their natural grazing behavior, will tend to overgraze, and that's where management comes in.
Sheep like grass to be 2 to 6 inches tall, but will overgraze if left on a pasture too long. Rotate them out. Cattle, on the other hand, like to graze a little higher up, something between 4 and 10 inches tall.
That doesn't mean that we don't have to worry about their grazing behavior, because we still want to maintain that 3 to 4 inch grass height when we move them out of a paddock, and they certainly will overgraze.
And then there's the king of the overgrazers, the horse.
Horses are another animal that just naturally will eat close to the ground because of the type of mouth parts that they have, and they certainly will overgraze and graze that grass right down to the ground. And depending on the species of grass that we have, that can kill out a good stand. So there are a lot of considerations that we need to make and utilize to manage the grazing behavior of our livestock just because of their natural ability and the choices that they make in grazing.
Choice is an interesting and useful perspective in the grazing world.
This is where goats are unique. Their mouthparts, a narrower muzzle and split upper lip, make them browsers rather than grazers. Goats can be considered pasture renovators and will be useful to control certain weeds and unwanted vegetation. They can return a mature pasture to a vegetative, higher quality stage of productivity. Generally, says Oswald, in a good pasture system, 6 to 8 goats consume as much as maybe 1 cow or 5 to 6 sheep. Heavy brush browse systems will support 9 to 11 goats, 6 to 7 sheep or a cow. With mixed species grazing, 1 or 2 goats or sheep could be added per cow grazing to improve pasture utilization. This uses the different feeding habits to manage pasture and optimize animal production. For University of Illinois Extension, I'm Todd Gleason.
Agricultural programs are made possible by First Midwest Bank, serving Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and McHenry. More information is available from Doug Slayton in Galesburg at 309-341-5003. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report. It's a Friday afternoon. Time to check in on the cash grain market. Bruce Bostard of the Ludlow Co-op Elevator Company out of Ludlow, Illinois, is with us. He manages 10 Illinois elevators. Good afternoon to you, Bruce.
Good afternoon.
When we talked with the folks at the Andersons in Delphi on Wednesday, they told us that there was quite a bit of corn movement there. How about in your area?
It's spotty depending on the day. When we get a strong uptick like we had earlier today, we had a bunch of offers got hit and bought some corn from offers and from new purchases during the day. Then when it sold back to the 2 to 3 cent higher range, not as much interest. So it's spotty.
It bought new crop corn or old corn?
Both. Both. We're seeing storage and DP getting priced on the old crop stuff and picking up some new crop. Beans, buying some beans, but smaller lots and generally seemed quieter.
What are producers saying about the condition of their fields at this point?
Considering the amount of rain we had, I think overall they're still pretty good. There's concern with the low spots. It's putting on an awful lot of height, though, and the thing is the market always has a hard time wrapping its arms around and trading too wet. It's a lot easier to get a rally coming off of forecast of some type of a dome forming than it is off of continued rain.
You know, many of our analysts have decided that they want to be at least friendly to the marketplace. As a cash grain person, can you do that? I'll take that as a no.
Longer term, I guess I can. If the board wants to rally right now, I think that we will see basis react negatively to it. We're shipping corn, but the shipment pace still isn't, on export-wise, isn't that great compared to what the projections are. We're still lagging behind the weekly pace needed.
And what are your bids for the day?
We are at 347 on nearby corn, 349 new crop. Beans, 966 and 894.
Thanks so much, Bruce.
Thank you.
Bruce Bostard is the manager of the Ludlow Co-op Elevator Company out of Ludlow, Illinois. He joins us here on the Closing Market Report each and every Friday afternoon. We'll be back in just a couple minutes when we'll talk with the folks at the Midwestern Regional Climate Center about the weather forecast.
Learnard Seed Service supports agricultural programs as an additional service to its customers. Learnard Seed Service is an independent dealer providing DeKalb and Asgrow seed products, including Genuity SmartStax corn hybrids, to farmers throughout East Central Illinois.
It's National Cherry Tart Day. Sweet cherries date back to prehistoric times in Asia. By the way, that story about George Washington and the cherry tree is more fiction than fact. Parson Weems attributed the anecdote to an aged lady who was a distant relative and, when a girl, spent much of her time who referred to George as cousin. Really, we cannot tell a lie. It's also International Picnic Day. In Europe during the 14th century, the earliest picnics were medieval hunting feasts in England, featuring hams and other baked meats as well as pastries.
picnicking really came into its own during the Victorian age. Picnics, as Americans know them, date back to the middle of the 19th century. On this day in agricultural history in 1865, Edmund Ruffin died. He was a pioneer in the study of soil chemistry in the U.S. Ruffin investigated the possibility of using lime to raise pH in peat soils to improve agricultural productivity. In 1892, macadamia nuts were first planted in Hawaii. In 1981, the first genetically engineered vaccine was announced by USDA. The vaccine, using gene splicing, was designed to prevent hoof and mouth disease. And in 1993, African honeybees killed a small dog in Tucson, Arizona, and were dubbed by the media as killer bees. Their original source was from crossbreeding with tropical African bees imported into Brazil for experimental work. And that's this day in agricultural history.
Support for agricultural programming comes from the Westchester Group, an agricultural asset management firm specializing in land auctions for farmland, timberland, and recreational land. More information on upcoming auctions is at westchester-auctions.com or at 800-607-6888.
You're listening to the Closing Mark Report on a Friday afternoon. Steve Hilberg of NOAA's Midwestern Regional Climate Center is with us to take a look at the weekend and agricultural weather forecast. Thanks, Steve, for being here.
Hey, Todd.
Many fathers will want to know that it's going to be a good weekend because it's Father's Day.
Right. Well, it doesn't look like it's going to be too bad if you like the heat and humidity. It's going to be a warm, sticky one, and it doesn't look like that's going to change in the near future very much. But right now, on Sunday, it will appear that high temperatures will be around or above 90 in many parts of Illinois, and dew points, as they are today, will probably be in the low to mid-70s. So might be good to give Dad a nice cool drink and let him sit in front of the TV and watch the ball games.
Yeah, and how much rainfall do you expect over the next week? We've had a lot in the month of June.
Yeah, we've, in many areas, we've already doubled or well over our normal June rainfall. Over the next week, I don't think we're going to see nearly as much as we had this week. We currently have a line of severe thunderstorms moving through northwestern Illinois from just north of Quincy up through the Quad Cities, almost along the Mississippi River there right now. And those will be dropping some pretty healthy amounts of rain, but that's one part of the state that doesn't need a lot either. I would think that over the next week or so, most areas won't see more than a half inch or so. The best chance, actually, will probably be about Wednesday when we could get another weak cold front through here, and that might put a line of thunderstorms through Illinois. Other than that, the ridge of high pressure aloft should keep things somewhat suppressed, and other than an isolated shower or thunderstorm popping up here and there, we're not going to get any widespread rain, I don't think, like we had this past week.
Now, how much wetter than normal are we?
Oh, way. As far as this month so far, we are well above normal. The temperature, the rainfall through this part of, or through mid-month right now, is already over twice normal. And the only area of the state that really hasn't seen it quite as much as far as southern Illinois, where the rainfall has just been a little bit below normal in some areas, but in general, we've been very wet, and the problem is, especially when it comes all in a couple days like it did this past week, it's really hard to get rid of it, and it's sitting on top of the ground in the fields and the ditches and re-radiating back into the atmosphere.
All right, thanks so much.
All right, Todd.
And that is, I wanted to say Jim Angel, but of course it's not. It's Steve Hilberg. He's the director of the Midwestern Regional Climate Center and belongs to NOAA, that is, the center does, and comes to us each and every Friday right here on the Closing Mark Report. If you get the opportunity and can, stay with us this afternoon for the Farming World. We'll talk with Bruce Blanton. He's authored a USDA transportation study on agriculture. Should make for an interesting conversation. And then we'll hear from Lisa Braltz. It's our regular Friday programming content in the Farming World. We call that one In My Backyard. You've been listening to the Closing Mark Report. Have a good afternoon. I'm Todd Gleason.
Agricultural information is made possible with support from ADM. ADM thanks America's farmers because everything they do starts with you.
This is the Farming World News and interviews from the Land Grant in Urbana-Champaign. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Today, we'll talk with Bruce Blanton. He's the Director of Transportation Services Division at USDA's Agricultural Marketing Service, and more importantly, the project manager for the 2010 study of rural transportation issues. It was released in April of this year. Mr. Blanton, thank you so much for joining us today.
I'm very pleased to be here. Thank you.
It is a very comprehensive study, some, I don't know, more than 600 pages, I think, if I rolled all the way down to the bottom of it, 607. Why don't you give me some of the key highlights to begin with?
Okay, I think I'll start, if it's okay, to basically let your listeners know kind of why the study came about. It was a study that was required by Congress in the 2008 Farm Bill. The Congress didn't ask us for recommendations, and we didn't provide any. But the approach of the report is to be educational, that is, to frame the issues for Congress and for stakeholders by providing information and background on the transportation issues that are important to agriculture. As you mentioned, the report is quite extensive. It includes 15 chapters, 15 substantive chapters, and basically covers the four major modes of transportation that are used by agriculture in the United States. That is truck, barge, rail, and ocean vessels. The report covers the importance of freight transportation for the delivery of agricultural commodities, renewable fuels, coal for generation of electricity, as well as economic development in rural areas. The Congress also asked us to explore the sufficiency of rail transportation capacity, competition, reliability of service, reasonableness of rates, facility investment, and the rate grievance process for shippers. So as you indicated, it's quite comprehensive, and it's the first time that this kind of information has all been compiled in one spot.
Shall we start with rail?
Sure, or if you want, we could also, I could give you kind of a high-level overview of some of the major findings of the study, whatever your preference.
Well, let's go with the highlights, and then we'll come back to rail.
Okay, very well. The study found there was a decrease in the unrestricted interchange of rail traffic, a decrease in routing choices, and of competition. And this was due mainly to the rapid consolidation of railroads through mergers. We also found that rail shippers are very concerned about a number of issues such as switching limitations, restricted interchange, paper barriers, inconsistent service, high rates, excessive fuel surcharges, bottleneck rates, and the ineffective rate challenge process. We found that the limited antitrust exemptions that railroads and ocean carriers enjoy create a potential for decreased competition, poorer service, and higher rates. The study found there's a growing gap for the inland waterways and for the highways. We explored the agricultural exemption to the driver's hours of service rules and found that this exemption is very important to agriculture because of its unique needs during planting and harvest season.
This is for truckers now, right?
Correct, yes.
Okay.
This is for truckers. We also explored multimodally the different modes and found that we believe a more systems perspective is needed for the transportation network instead of the current approach, which is modal. In other words, funding highways separately than ocean or rail or barge. We believe those should be looked at from a more holistic system perspective. So in a nutshell, those were kind of some of the top line key findings of the study.
So in the holistic perspective,
the National Weather Service has issued a severe thunderstorm watch, which remains in effect until 7 p.m. In the WILL severe weather coverage area, that watch covers Ford, Iroquois, and McLean counties. Again, a severe thunderstorm watch for Ford, Iroquois, and McLean counties until 7 p.m.
Things needed to be updated, or if they all needed to be updated and simultaneously.
And how they compete and cooperate together to be a seamless network. Right now, the it's not like the system is bad. It does a good job. We've got one of the best transportation systems in the world. But it could use improvement. And what the point we're making is that when you're deciding what your infrastructure is, whether it be rail or highways or barges or ports, you should look at the entire picture from a systems perspective, not just make your decision on how you're going to fund the highways, divorced from what you're going to do with rail or what you're going to do with ports or what you're going to do with barges.
Let's take up rail in a bit more depth now. There was a large consolidation of the rail industry, and it happened fairly recently. What kind of impact does your study show that it has had?
Well, rail really is the only cost-effective mode of transportation to many agricultural producers. Rail competition is vital to agricultural shippers since the railroads have certain exemptions from antitrust laws. We found that rail-to-rail competition for grain and oilseeds, for example, decreased between 1992 and 2007. And almost 75% of the agricultural areas lost rail competition over that period. Areas with a rail monopoly in transporting grain and oilseeds increased from 10 to 15%, and the revenue to variable cost ratio increased in 83% of those agricultural areas. Rail rates for grain and oilseeds are higher than those for other commodities, and they have increased faster from 2003 to 2007. For example, grain and oilseed rates increased by 46% compared to 32% for all other commodities over the period. We found that during the 2001 to 2007 period, quarterly railroad fuel surcharges ranged from 55 to 137% higher than the incremental increase in the cost of fuel, which boosted railroad profits.
So railway is the one place that carries a whole lot of agricultural products, but here in the Midwest, where we have access to the river transportation system, the Illinois, the Ohio, and the Mississippi rivers, and the locks and dams, this is a place that handles, I think, something like 57%, the river transportation system as a whole, that is, of corn exported into the world market. Can you tell me what you found in the study about the river transportation system?
Sure, I'd be glad to do that. Barges move more than a third of our corn exports and over a sixth of our soybean exports to New Orleans to be shipped overseas. We found actually the modal share of barges has been slowly shrinking for a number of years, and the traffic on the waterways has declined. Although the locks and dams on the inland waterway system are generally reliable, but the repairs and maintenance have become more extensive and expensive with age. We also found that the Inland Waterways Trust Fund, which finances 50% of the capital cost of the inland waterways, has been declining since 2002. The lack of a clear path forward on funding, frankly, is of significant concern to farmers that depend on the waterways to move their crops to market. And the funding to maintain and rehabilitate the existing infrastructure needs to remain a priority.
Why has that allocation been going down since 2002? It surprises me because that's just a fund that's captured out of, or at least part of it that's captured from the private fleet, is a surtax on, it's a fuel charge.
In simple strokes, it's the revenue coming in
from fuel taxes has been declining, and the expenses have been going up. So, you know, over time, if you spend more than it's coming in, then the balances decline.
What did you find with the locks and dams themselves? Were there any things in the study that jump out at you? For instance, you always hear from the corn growers that the locks and dams simply aren't big enough, that a 600-foot lock isn't big enough to handle the size of tows that are running up and down the Illinois and Mississippi rivers at this point.
Yeah, that's clearly an issue that agricultural interests are concerned about. We found that the aging system, however, is generally reliable. But like I indicated earlier, the repairs and the maintenance become more extensive and therefore more expensive.
I understand that you can't make recommendations or weren't asked to make recommendations by Congress, and that they'll take up that issue separately.
Right, and what we were trying to do is provide background information so that we could educate them on the issues. It's really their job to take that information and do with it what they will.
Now, when you talk about the river system, we need to move into ocean freight as well. Because, of course, that's what the river system is in the United States is designed to handle, ocean freight, both coming into the United States and going out of the United States. What do you find with the ports and the ocean freights and the number of ships that are available?
Yeah, ports and ocean transportation are essential for agricultural exports. For example, in the past 5 years, over half our wheat, over a third of our soybeans, and over a sixth of our corn were exported. One of the things we found is more than half of U.S. agricultural exports by value, not by volume, but by value, move in marine shipping containers, and they include all types of agricultural products from bulk grains to frozen beef. The agricultural shippers that use containerized shipping are finding that containers and sufficient vessel capacity are one of the greatest challenges facing their business. And the recent decline in import cargo for consumer goods reduced the availability of containers for export cargo, and actually in some cases resulted in lost sales and unreliable service to overseas buyers. The infrastructure and technological improvements that are needed to expand capacity and to accommodate forecasted growth in U.S. trade and to avoid costly congestion at port.
I did make note that there were what I thought a very large number of ocean-going vessels, and that in the report it suggested, and while there are some times when there aren't enough available, that there were enough ships, generally speaking, available that And there was enough competition that they really did react to the marketplace. Did I read that correctly?
That's correct. Yes. Basically, the high shipping rates before the recession has slowed the scrapping of vessels and spurred building, but in moderated rates. But those companies have been responding to the current downturn by removing ships from the fleet or laying them up.
Now let's move to the last mode of transportation. That's the trucking industry. It is responsible, I suppose, for the bulk of movement of agricultural trade throughout the United States.
That's correct. In fact, trucks carry 70% of agricultural tonnage and normally include the first and the last movements in the supply chain. Trucking is highly competitive, and because of that, it keeps rates low.
Thank you so much, Mr. Blanton, for being with us today. We do appreciate your time.
Thank you so much.
We've been talking today here on The Farming World with Bruce Blanton. He is the Director of Transportation Services Division at USDA's Agricultural Marketing Service. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason.
This is Illinois Public Media Director of Agricultural Programming, Dave Dickey. In business news, President Barack Obama has asked America's G20 trading partners to work closely with him to safeguard and strengthen the recovery from the near collapse of the global economic system in the fall of 2008. Looking ahead to the coming G20 summit in Toronto, Obama noted in a letter that, quote, significant weaknesses linger among the major and developing economic powers. He told his summit partners, quote, "It is essential that we have a self-sustaining recovery that creates the good jobs that our people need." Campbell's Soup Company is recalling 15 million pounds of SpaghettiOs with meatballs after a cooker malfunctioned at one of the company's plants in Texas and left the meat undercooked. USDA says there are no reports of illnesses associated with the product. The recalled products have EST4K, as well as a use-by date between June 2010 and December 2011, printed on the bottom of the can. European Commission President José Manuel Barroso today says that the European Union will expand banking stress tests across the entire sector after it had conducted tests on the largest 25 banks. EU leaders agreed at a summit in Brussels yesterday to publish the results of the stress tests on the EU's 25 biggest banks on a bank-by-bank basis. And that's a look at today's business news. Hi, this is Illinois Public Media Director of Agricultural Programming, Dave Dickey. Up next, reaching into the chicken coop for a handful of fresh eggs isn't just a farm activity. A number of cities, including Urbana, allow residents to keep fowl. Lisa Braltz talks to some urban chicken wranglers in this week's edition of In My Backyard.
A couple of weeks ago, my husband called me at the office to let me know he had just seen something I might find interesting. He was in Urbana on his way back to his office from running an errand, he said, when he spotted a woman walking down the street with her chicken. We're hardly strangers to fowl here in Urbana, Illinois. People have legally, and quietly for the most part, been keeping chickens within city limits for ages. And there have been a couple of mini explosions of urban fowl activity in the last decade. In fact, I'd say we're in the middle of one of these explosions right now. I'm sure this is due, at least in part, to enhanced awareness about where food comes from, and especially about how animals are raised before we eat them or their byproducts. I figured, though, that everyone who makes the decision to keep chickens, to take the step of bringing home these creatures that are way different than anything with, say, fur, has a good reason for it. There's a story behind it. The houses in our part of the city are quite small by current standards, but the yards are pretty generous. Some friends of ours in the neighborhood have an awesome garden situation in their backyard. Theirs is the garden that inspired me to first start growing food. This family has spent two decades filling the space with raised beds for growing vegetables, growing yet more vegetables up trellises, planting and moving perennial flowers and herbs. And the result is this incredibly rowdy, colorful, verdant, and lush space that is also totally functional. About 10 years ago, the old dog run was no longer being used, so it made sense, said one of my friends, to clean it out and add six chickens to the mix, especially since they provide food for their keepers and excellent manure for the garden, and having chickens would be a great learning experience for their then young children. However, our friends, who still have several chickens and now ducks, aren't sentimental about it. They definitely see their birds as part of their backyard food production scenario. When they outlive their usefulness, said the other of my friends, a bird's time on the tiny farmlet has come to an end. In this case, poultry aren't really seen as pets. Others, though, see them as both agricultural contributors and as pets. Another poultry arrangement in the neighborhood is between two households, and it came about suddenly when neighbors who had chickens were moving overseas. Karen Klebe was a reluctant chicken owner.
I was vehemently opposed to chickens. Sam wanted them right away when we got the house, and I was just like, no. They're smelly, they're messy, and quite honestly, I just didn't want to be those people.
We'd had this joke in our marriage that there were only two things in our prenuptial agreement. They were no chickens and no minivan.
Her husband, Sam Vandegrift, remembers it a bit differently.
We had some friends who were moving out of the country, and they'd gotten birds about a year ago, and we saw them raised from chicks up through pullets, and then They started laying eggs, and it was really awesome watching them discover what it was like to have birds and raise animals that they were going to eat something from. I remember my spouse surprised me by suggesting that we take the birds in, which I thought was really quite a transformation from where we were. Absolutely, absolutely not. And I wasn't quite sure, actually. I was suspicious. So I thought that there was actually a gold caravan on the way. So
Sam and Karen's partners in this endeavor are their next-door neighbors, Ryan Griffiths and Sarah Ross. While Sarah, who isn't really an egg eater, was pretty interested in raising chickens, Ryan, who does eat eggs, was rather indifferent to the whole idea until the chance came, he said, to inherit these ready-made chickens. They knew the coop would reside next door with Karen and Sam, but decided that in order to give the chickens more room to range, they would get out the bolt cutters and cut a hole in the fence to enable the chickens to move between yards. It's an arrangement that exists to this day, though they've had to create more fencing in order to keep the chickens from totally devouring their garden. Ryan sees the birds as occupying this in-between space. Not quite pets, but not quite farm animals either.
They're not like dogs or cats in the sense that they come into the house with you later. We don't have names for them or call them and expect them to behave in the way that you expect pets to behave or to return any kind of affection. It's not necessarily like that, but probably I would think that we worry about them probably more than most people who are raising, you know, like a larger number of chickens.
Life with chickens isn't perfect. Even though they forage all day long, they do require feeding. They need structures to live in. Predators can sometimes be a problem, and occasionally they can get sick and pass away suddenly. When one of the four ready-made chickens died without warning, Sam was really upset. He said it made him rethink his initial desire to learn how to slaughter his own birds. A couple of months later, he's still not sure he wants to. And Karen appreciates them way more than she thought she would. They're a really great cheering section when you're out working in the yard, she says. They're friendly. They'll eat anything. Plus, eggs. It kind of makes a girl want to build a coop for a few ready-made chickens in her backyard. Just don't tell my husband.
Lisa Brott's stories can also be heard on our website, willang.org. Click on the In My Backyard link in the right navigation window. And you can read her occasional blogs at majorprogression.wordpress.com. If you have a story idea for In My Backyard, we would love to hear it. Drop us an email at willagstaff.org. That's willagstaff.org.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.